Foundation, the sounds of the Asian Dub Foundation.
Yes, yes.
Okay, it's 9:01. You're tuned into WBAI 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Asia Pacific Forum. Okay, good evening. You're listening in the background to the sound of Asian Dub Foundation. The track is Jericho from their 1995 record Facts and Fictions. And that sound means you're tuned into another edition of Asia Pacific Forum, the weekly Pan-Asian radio hour here on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio in New York City. You can also listen to us live on the web now at www.asiapacificforum.com. org. That's one word, Asia Pacific Forum. I'm Andy Hsiao of the Asia Pacific Forum Collective, and I'll be co-hosting tonight with Aniruddha Das of the APF Collective and the Samar Collective. Hi, Aniruddha.
Hi, Andy.
So tonight, in just more than a week, the World Economic Forum will roll into New York, and with it, more than 1,000 elite government and corporate figures from around the world. And also, we very much hope, thousands of protesters. But just what is the World Economic Forum, and why should we care about it? Well, tonight we'll have a WEF primer, a kind of crash course in the history of the World Economic Forum, its effects on the world economy, and the many ways it's being challenged, including through the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. That's also starting next week. We'll also preview some of the many actions that are being planned around the World Economic Forum right here in New York. But first up tonight, we're going to take a less traveled road to the corporate scandal of the moment, Enron. We're going to hear about the history of Enron in India, where it has been an enormous poster child for the kinds of policies that have come to be associated with the World Economic Forum. Aniruddha?
Thanks, Andy. And also, in parenthesis, it's wonderful to be doing this program with you, and it's wonderful to be back in WBAI, where we don't have to keep looking over our shoulders and wondering what to say and what not to say, not that we worried too much about that in the past.
Well, that's true. This is a truly free WBAI, and that's a great thing.
So coming to Enron. In talking about Enron here in the U.S., most of the focus has been on financial corruption, corruption in the boardroom, in the accounting firms, in campaign contributions, with some mention of the real effects on the real lives of real people. For example, of the many Enron employees who lost all their pension savings in this scandal. But Enron also has a long and gory history in other parts of the world, like India, where their actions have saddled the countries with immense destructive projects set to destroy the country's power infrastructure, impoverish 65 million people, and drain away the assets of an entire country. And Enron managed to push through such destructive policies in India with the presumed help not only of a corrupt Indian bureaucracy, but also with the active and constant pressure from U.S. officials, Republican and Democrat. In the last week, there has been some coverage in the U.S. press of Vice President Dick Cheney applying pressure on India on Enron's behalf. But the history of Enron goes back much further, to 1992. For the first part of our show, we interview Abhay Mehta. He was trained as a molecular biologist from MIT before returning to Bombay and getting interested in the affairs of Enron, and his book Power Play, published in 2000, laid bare much of this gory history. I spoke to Abhay a few hours ago in Bombay. The sound quality of this interview to start with is not great for just the first few minutes, but it improves, so stay tuned. Here is Abhay.
Well, firstly, thanks for having me. Enron in India has been touted as the harbinger of the best that America has to offer. We can start, you know, in 1991, where we had what was then a quote-unquote mixed economy. That is, you had elements of both the state as well as the private sector participating in the economy. specifically, for example, if I look at the utility industry, you had mainly in their favor a couple of very small players. Most of the electricity in India was controlled by the state, which is, by the way, this is not such an unusual feature. For example, if I look at France, you have electricity there, France, which is a state-owned body, which is, you know, it is not to say that state is better or worse here. I'm just sort of recounting the factual narrative. In this, the electricity sector was opened up, and Enron was the first company to really take the plunge, and they invested claimed to have invested large amounts of money in setting up a power plant about 260 kilometers south of Bombay.
The Indian government was under a lot of pressure to liberalize, to open up its economy at that time?
Not just under pressure, it was absolutely necessary, because in 91 we were on the verge of literally a financial breakdown. And in exchange for loans which were given to us then, we had agreed to open up a number of parts of the Indian economy where there was no private capital or foreign capital allowed. The telecom sector, for example, the entire telephone industry or mobile or whatever, the entire telecom sector was absolutely off-limits. And that was obviously as a part of the pressure.
So now returning to the history of the building of this power plant.
You had this American corporation which came in cowboy style. For example, we have a fair amount of documentation on internal correspondence that went back and forth, and they're describing that these Indian laws are no good, this is no good, that's no good, and it's basically of no particular consequence, and we need to get in there and change things, and we need to change things really fast. Exit style, which is what it was. This power plant, which finally is not quite set up, by the way, after all this, was one of the largest in the world then, 2,000-odd megawatts. This was a contract for the supply of electricity to the state utility that Enron set up a company in India which built this power plant to supply electricity to the state utility. Now, at the rates that were agreed on then, and I'm talking again 1993, when the first agreement was signed, it would turn out that this would be probably one of the largest civilian contracts in world history. The value of the contract then, or for that matter, if I look at it now, was somewhere to the tune of 35 to 40 billion US dollars. These are very, very, very large numbers by any standard anywhere in the world. You know, a typical large defense deal, for example, is $1 billion, $1.5 billion. So we are talking of cash flows year on year for 20 years of the order of $1.4 to $1.5 billion a year coming out of a single project in Maharashtra to this company. There were three issues then, and which is what triggered of my interest. I have nothing to do with energy per se, trained as a molecular biologist. One was obviously the meta-economics. We're talking obscenely large sums of money. Second is the fundamental issue that you're buying a commodity for which, even by your own admission and your own, as in the government or the World Bank or any such thing, that there is no real need. There are shortages of electricity at peak times. That's, let's say, at 9 in the morning, everybody turns on their geysers, hot water boilers. At 12 in the night, there's a massive surplus in the Maharashtra system because, you know, whatever, people have gone off to sleep, there are very few night shifts. Now, turns out the Enron contract, they had agreed to buy electricity for 22 hours a day. In other words, I had to buy what turned out to be the most expensive electricity in the world.
At 14 cents a unit, that's compared to 4 cents a unit average in this country, in the U.S., and about 1 to 1.5 cents a unit in India, in the state of Maharashtra, in the state-owned power plant at that time.
I have to actually stop producing electricity at 1 to 1.5 cents because I am contractually obligated to buy electricity worth 14 and 15 cents.
We are talking to Abhay Mehta, whose book Power Play looks at the long and gory history of Enron in India.
This very high cost, not only did the state utility have to buy this electricity at this high rate, whether or not it needed it, its purchase was also guaranteed by the state of Maharashtra.
That's right. The state has guaranteed that whatever monies which were due under the contract, the state would pay. And you're talking of really ridiculously large sums of money. We're talking of something like $1.4 billion odd dollars a year on year for 20 years. the entire cash flow of the project over 20 years was guaranteed and backed by all the assets of the state of Maharashtra. The state of Maharashtra is the largest state in India, and it's also the richest state. To put this in perspective,
it's a state of which Bombay is the capital.
Financial and the commercial capital of India. So if you can think of a state which is, you know, somewhere California and New York combined, and perhaps throw in, you know, Texas or Washington for luck, we are talking of an economic powerhouse like that. 25% of India's economy really comes out of Maharashtra directly and indirectly.
And one third of the entire state budget of this was going to be paid as the revenue stream to Enron.
That's absolutely right. The state's budget last year was $3.8 billion. And we are talking of paying Enron off 1.4, perhaps 1.5. Close to well over a third of the state's budget. You have what I think is a very unique situation in commercial history. We're talking of commercial history of the last 300 odd years. I mean, anywhere in the world.
And not only did the state get this guarantee, but the country, the state, the Republic of India, gave a counter guarantee in the contract.
That's correct. It gets curiouser and curiouser. So if all this was not bad enough and absolutely, absolutely unprecedented, we have yet another guarantee given by the Union of India saying that in case the government of Maharashtra does not pay, we will pay. And this in turn was backed by the assets of the Indian Republic, you know, every asset that India holds.
Right. The Indian government gave up contractually its immunity to any assets it has now or it might acquire in the future, everything excepting diplomatic and military assets.
Absolutely.
Could be put on lien in order to pay Enron whatever money Enron decided it needed to be paid as a part of this contract.
Absolutely. I mean, you've summarized it far better than I could.
Now, in this whole question of opening up the country, the economy and liberalization, the big argument is that foreign companies bring foreign investment into the country and bring technology that the country needs. In this case, was Enron actually investing any money?
You look at a simple issue like foreign investment. They claim that it's a, you know, $3 billion investment. Well, maybe yes, maybe no, because to begin with, you have a clone station in Korea being built at $1 billion. One-third the cost. Absolutely clone with the same turbines, the same engines, that is a GE Frame 9F turbines. 2,000 megawatts, LNG-5. So there's no difference and there is no way that, quote-unquote, Indian costs would be this high. B, that the Indian financial institutions, you have a series of the equivalent of U.S. Exim and OPIC, but local, you know, for development of local industry, giving loans to Enron for the development of this project. And if that was not bad enough, they further have gone on to guarantee the loans that Enron has gotten, that Enron raised money from the U.S. markets as well as the European markets. And the Indian institutions have guaranteed. Now, if you look at what is happening today, the foreign bankers which have invested money in this this consortium of foreign bankers and others have absolutely no risk. The bottom line is Indian. That is, in this case, which has already happened, Enron defaulted on the payments. And since it did, the recourse to the foreign lenders is back to square one, India. So you have nothing being brought to the table. Absolutely nothing. A risk-free, costless project generating money.
So, in other words, even though Enron at that time had 65% ownership of this project, and interestingly, 10% of the project was owned by GE and Bechtel, two other names which are quite familiar to our listeners, Enron had, in effect, not put in almost a single cent of its own money.
No, quite the contrary. I suspect, and in fact, this we can probably validate that, Enron made about $400 million odd dollars in the construction. When my project has cost me $1 billion to make, and let's throw in 50% more, you know, for quote-unquote Indian costs, whatever they are, and we'll perhaps go into some of these details later. The cost that I've claimed are $3 billion, and I've raised loans worth $2 billion against it. So I've already taken home $300 to $400 million, over and above which the cash flow is mine.
Right. So, given that this project was clearly so deleterious to Indian needs. How is it possible that the state utility, the state government of Maharashtra and the state of India could sign such a contract? I mean, we have no smoking gun of corruption.
No, you do have a very clear smoking gun of corruption, where we have Enron's own admission, where they said in a congressional testimony that we spent then, I'm talking of the first phase of the project, over $20 million in quote-unquote educating Indian officials and Indian banks on how to lend. So it's very clear and they very specifically go on to claim that these are expenses, incurred over and above normal project expenses.
But talk a little bit about the pattern of the way the contract was signed. And
there are two interesting episodes in this. Episode number one is a testimony that the then CIA director gave to the Congress in early 1994. There was a New York Times report and subsequently reported elsewhere. The testimony was mostly harmless. He was trying to justify, Congress was trying to cut money. This was the end of the Cold War and, the quote-unquote famed peace dividend that never materialized. And there was this debate going back and forth that we should be cutting these budget, that budget, blah, blah. And the CIA director was trying to justify, obviously, the fact that his budget need not be cut. And one of the examples he gave was the fact that we help American economic interests. And the example he gave was the power station in this Indian state of Maharashtra, where they helped an American company gain the contract. Again, the interesting thing is, one is obviously it is an admission by the director himself, and B, the fact that, for example, in this particular contract, there were no competitors, there was no bidding. It was simply a memorandum of understanding between two parties that fructified later into a contract. So you clearly have, and I suspect the old-fashioned thing, that the CIA and or other related entities obviously used levers that they had, or obviously they still do have, in identifying the weak points of the Indian polity, which helped Enron gain entry.
So now this is, despite the fact that even groups like the World Bank had opposed this project because economically this would be
We are talking to Abhay Mehta, whose book, Power Play, looks at the long and gory history of Enron in India.
I mean, a very simple example is the erstwhile ambassador to India, Frank Wisner. We have him on record maybe, 700 odd times. You wouldn't believe this number in his tenure here, talking only about Enron and how it...
Interestingly, after leaving India, Wisner became a director of the Enron-affiliated company, Enron Oil and Gas.
That's absolutely correct. A old-fashioned revolving door. You scratch my back, I scratch your back.
The U.S. government officials have been involved in this process of pushing Enron on India right from the beginning.
So whether you have the Clinton administration or you have the now current VP, Cheney, among others, he talks to the leader of the Indian opposition, etc., etc., in his capacity as the vice president, worrying about Enron. And these things are obviously taken very seriously when you have the vice president of the U.S. telling me that I need to worry about it. There's a lot which I suspect will be uncovered, if at all there is an investigation over the next few months, to find involvement of political figures both in India as well as in the U.S. as, beneficiaries of the Enron dole queue.
To emphasize that this is something which cuts across party boundaries, when Ron Brown, Clinton's Secretary of Commerce, came to India, Ken Lay, the chief executive of Enron, came with him on the same plane to push for Enron's power project. And when Richard Celeste, Clinton's ambassador to India, left, in his farewell speech, he talked down to Indian officials and threatened them that no further U.S. investment in India unless India paid up this outrageous sums of money that Enron was demanding.
Yes, absolutely. He was looking for a job. He's doing what his predecessor did.
About the patterns of the signing of the contract in India. Even in India, the corruption apparently crosses party lines. When the contract was first signed in 1991-92, it was signed in record time. This is the contract, as you talked about, which was going to be possibly the largest civilian contract in world history. The initial memorandum of understanding was decided upon with just 72 hours. Contract was signed within just 1 week. This was signed by a Congress government, the party which also happened to then be in power both at the center in India as well as in the state of Maharashtra. Now, when this contract was signed, there was a huge outcry about all these horrendous conditions that you've already described. And in fact, a Hindu nationalist government came into power in the state of Maharashtra on the campaign promise of...
Only, in fact, almost solely on the campaign promise of getting, throwing, I shall quote, Enron into the Arabian Sea.
Curiously, what happened 3 months after they came into power?
After coming to power, they ordered an investigation. They actually went on to file a suit where they claimed that this contract was signed on purely on the basis of corruption, fraud, as well as misrepresentation by Enron on various accounts. And they went on to substantiate it with 400 pages of voluminous documentation. Now, very abruptly, almost overnight, they changed their stand and they, went on to withdraw all these allegations. And these were not allegations per se, they were substantiated by documentation and their own evidence. There is nothing on record to date or a justification to date saying why did the government do this, and they went on to sign a contract which in a sense was three times as worse as the old contract.
And right, and in the second contract that they signed, they in fact included clauses which prevented the state government from breaking any future contracts with...
Not just breaking, but it gets on to be far worse. That, for example, that if at all the contract was broken and or not followed, even trivially, the Enron would be compensated to the sum total of the net present value of the profits over 20 years that they expected to derive out of the contract. They were, really ridiculous and absurd clauses which were put in by this government which came to power saying that this is what is going to bankrupt us and we don't need it.
One of the major... the evidence for corruption is this pattern of the way the contract was signed in India. And then there is, of course, the smoking gun that you did refer to earlier. Enron actually openly admitted an item of $20 million of...
on quote-unquote educating Indian officials.
$20 million over and above construction costs.
No, project costs. Of all project costs, these are expenditures over and above that.
Right. Over and above project costs for quote-unquote educating Indian banking officials. So I want to end by coming back again to the issue of how destructive these policies are to the... to common people. I mean, there is in this country, in the U.S., a lot of the attention has been focused on how there is this corruption in the boardroom,
campaign donations,
and then Arthur Anderson. But there is also a real cost to real people. For example, all the Enron employees who saw their pension funds disappear. In countries like India, this actually goes much, much further. You have a company coming in this cowboy manner, in total disregard, where it openly in its documents it says that it disregards Indian laws. It sets up this project where it does not invest any money at all, gets a guaranteed revenue of $35 billion. It is not bringing any technology into the country. There is no technology transfer. There is nothing that benefited India. Overall plundering of the economy that we see is something which is a real cost borne by real people, much more than just a little bit of corruption in the boardroom.
We are talking of 65 million citizens. We are talking of the richest state in the Indian Union being reduced to abysmal levels of poverty because of a single contract. We're talking of, look at it from a very, very old person, very old and perhaps a, radical viewpoint, that we're talking of revolution in the state of Maharashtra because of a single contract. We're talking of colonialism in another form, directly and indirectly, dehumanizing of 65 million people, living in abject poverty because of this one single company.
That was Abhay Mehta. He's trained as a molecular biologist from MIT, then went back to Bombay about 10 years ago. And in his book, Power Play, published in 2000, he lays bare this gory history of Enron, of its of the open bribery and corruption of government officials in India and the pressure that U.S. officials, both Democrat and Republicans, brought to bear on India to accept Enron and accept these outrageous expenses that Enron was charging. Well, Abhay, just to bring things a little bit up to date, did file a case with the Supreme Court in India, along with the left trade union, CITU, filed a case on the illegality of this contract that had been signed with Enron based on the fact that it had never got any clearances from the Central Electric Authority. That case has been languishing in the Supreme Court in India, as you can imagine. More recently, the state of Maharashtra, that is the state in which this power plant, Dabhol, was situated, has now refused consciously to pay any of it, of the money owed to Enron. It realized that it was going to end up paying one-third of the entire state budget, that is more than the entire education budget of the whole state, to Enron. So it has consciously refused to pay, basing its refusal on certain contractual clauses, and things are in quite a state of flux where it is hoping that this, that the current scandal around Enron in this country will help it in pushing through this refusal to pay. You are listening to Asia Pacific Forum, 99.5 WBAI, listener-sponsored radio right here in New York City, where we bring you a different look at what is now the scandal of the month, the scandal maybe of the year. I'm Anirudha Das, co-hosting with Andy Shao. And after this very brief music break, we'll be right back with a look at the World Economic Forum, the World Social Forum, and what to make of all of it. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back to Asia Pacific Forum on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Andy Shao, and with me is Anirudha Das. We were hearing about the sordid history of Enron in India. Now let's turn from specific malfeasance to general. Next week, an estimated 3,000 corporate and government figures will descend on New York for the annual World Economic Forum, which will be held beginning next Thursday this year at our own city's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. They'll be met by numerous protests in the streets of New York and a massive parallel forum being held in Porto Alegre, Brazil, the World Social Forum. But just what is the World Economic Forum? Why should we care about it? And what can we do about it? With us to help break down the WEF are Anuradha Mittal, co-director of the San Francisco-based Food First Institute for Food and Development Policy, a leading progressive think tank and activist organization focusing on food as a human right. Anuradha, are you there?
Yes, I am, Andy.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also we're lucky to have with us right now Doug Henwood, economic journalist, editor of the Left Business Observer, host of the Thursday edition of Behind the News here on WBAI, and author of a number of books, including Wall Street, a Verso book, and a forthcoming New Press book on the new economy. Doug, are you there?
I'm here.
Great, thanks.
Doug, why don't you start by giving us the primer? What is the WEF? What was its history? And what can we expect from it?
Well, it's a private organization headquartered in Switzerland, and it is famous for its annual meetings in which leading corporate and political figures...
In Davos, Switzerland. Famous Davos.
Yes, the site of the tuberculosis sanitarium, the Magic Mountain, above nothing. And I think they've been doing this for about 20 years, but it got... Well, it's starting to get a lot more prominent the last few years as people's political interest in so-called globalization increased. But they were, in the late 90s, mid-90s, late 90s, when times were relatively good, they were a time when world's business and political and journalistic elite got together to slap each other in the back and just puff out their chest and feel good about themselves because it looked like they had... won everything. After the demonstrations in Seattle at the WTO in 99, they started getting a little more troubled and worried that their easy dominance of the world was now being challenged in a way that it hadn't before. And then there's there was financial crisis, recession. So the mood in the last couple hadn't been as cheerful as it was 95, 96, 97 during the really fat years of the boom. And then this year, as an act of solidarity with the people of New York City, after September 11th, they decided to hold Davos on the Hudson. So we're being greeted by these folks. This is an important institution in the construction of a global ruling class. It's where corporate titans and political leaders and journalists and academics, the journalists and academics who work for them, really get together to consider the state of the world, to puff up each other's egos, and to do some long-term planning. But there's a kind of anthropological angle. This is a way of creating social bonds, of creating a real sense of class identity and class consciousness among this elite. And we hear a lot of rhetoric about the beauties of the free market, it's so often the case that the elite really plans at a very high level over a very long term, and this is one of the things that they're doing in events like this World Economic Forum. It's kind of informal. They're not drawing out detailed 5-year plans or anything, but it's really the way they think about the long term strategic issues facing their class.
In that sense, it is very distinct from a body like the World Trade Organization, which is in the business of making detailed specific plans. This is more like an old boys club, from what you're saying,
exactly.
A wealthy old boys club of people who are just well connected with each other and want to maintain those connections.
Well, and to develop and deepen, really, I think a lot of people meet each other. There are a lot of friendships and bonds made over dinner. I think the social angle is important for the creation of class just as much as angle is.
It might be worth it just to detail some of the figures who are coming. It's a pretty heady crowd. Among the co-chairs of the meeting this year are the chairs and CEOs of Unilever, the Fuji Xerox company, Niall Fitzgerald, Merck and Company, and so on and so forth, as well as the Chancellor of Germany, the Prime Minister of Australia, Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, Bill Clinton will be there, The Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, Colin Powell is going to be there. Rudy Giuliani is one of the co-chairs. So it's quite an elite crowd. And Doug, who funds the organization?
I don't know the answer to that.
It is funded by the contributions of 1,000 of the world's foremost corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Doug presented a really good analysis of this organization. It's actually incorporated as a non-profit. And I think that's really important that it is enlisted as a non-profit and then it manages to get contributions of the world's leading corporations. And as you said, it's an old boys club for discussion between the world's major political and business leaders on how to drive the process of globalization. And one quick thing I would just add, that it proclaims actually to be the birthplace of the World Trade Organization. So it might not be designing rules for the global economy, but it is very much setting the process by how we move forward.
Well, that's Anuradha Mittal, co-director of the San Francisco-based Food First. Anuradha, on that theme, now, stung by some criticism last year at the exclusion of non-governmental organizations, and also stung by the fact that there was for the first time a significant amount of protests at Davos, and the Swiss police were actually forced to digress from their normally rather genteel image by turning water cannons on these unruly protesters. The WEF has invited a large number of so-called non-governmental organizations this time. It has also put on a fair amount of window dressing. There is a global compact of self-regulation of corporations, which Kofi Annan of the UN has been pushing as well. There is an environmental sustainability index. What do you make of all of this?
Well, you know, as I said, here is an organization which basically is an old boys club of corporate leaders and financial heads of different countries. And then it tries to put a human face. And, it, you know, in its mission, it says that it is committed to improving the state of the world. But this is really about meetings to promote their own corporate interests. And as you just said, that if there's been a protest to have an impact on the economic policies which impact millions around the world, they basically bring in the police forces. So yes, to kind of counter some of the criticism which has been growing from the civil society, they have brought in, you know, this time especially, heads of different faith-based groups. They have brought in some, you know, non-profit organizations. But then, hey, you know, World Economic Forum is a non-profit itself. You know, that's what it claims to be. So, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a non-profit. So I think the question is in terms of who from the civil society represent and what constituency they represent. Do they represent the working poor, the hungry, the homeless, you know, our trade unions? Those people are actually missing on the table, and that is what the protest is about.
Well,
although I think John Sweeney does go to these things now and then.
So. I think he has been invited to this year's WEF, in fact, and he'll be inside as well as perhaps leading a march on the outside.
And if all goes well, I should be covering it for The Nation from the inside, so I will be...
Oh, is that right? How interesting.
I just got the press credential application today, so I hope it all goes through. But
Well, maybe before we return to some more details about it, Anuradha, maybe you could tell us a bit about the World Social Forum, this alternative in Porto Alegre.
Well, actually, you know, World Economic Forum would like to create a firewall between economic and social policy, and that's what they have managed to do since 1971 when they were incorporated. So the World Social Forum is really an answer and alternative to these business leaders who are making decisions on our lives and about, you know, how we regulate our lives and about economies. So World Social Forum is going to meet for the second time in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And this is civil society from around the world, which comprises of think tanks to peasant groups from around the world to, you know, labor movement, women's rights groups, immigrant rights groups. We are all coming together. And at this place, we basically are looking at social and economic policy hand in hand to come together with an alternative, which would actually make the possibility of a better world, you know, a reality. So from World Economic Forum, we do see economic policies which have resulted in devastation for millions of people around the world, and not just in the third world, in the U.S. as well, and rich countries like the U.S. So this alternative that will come from Porto Alegre at the World Social Forum is really targeted at our message, which is a better world is possible. And that alternative will come through consultation, through dialogue, through process with everyone in our communities and not just with business heads.
Well, has the World Social Forum produced programs, concrete effects? Does the World Social Forum have the opportunity or the means to affect change? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that compared to 3,000 few people who will gather together in New York, you know, these business and, you know, heads of different state to talk about economic policies, at Porto Alegre, we're expecting over 12,000 people who represent millions of people and who have been given the task to go and represent them to draft those alternatives. Secondly, just for example, they're holding assemblies on what kind of people's budget do we want that would actually make a dent in hunger, a dent in poverty and homelessness. I don't see anything like that on the agenda of World Economic Forum. It provides opportunities to these, you know, thousands of business leaders to, you know, devise ways to, you know, seek more corporate profit for themselves. Whereas they're not talking about people's budget, which take into account, you know, the concerns of the working poor around the world. And also, World Social Forum, I'm really delighted, has the support of the Workers' Party in Brazil. So the government is involved as well. And so this is a really coming together of governments with the civil society and the real civil society and farmers groups and others.
I just want to say that you're listening to Asia Pacific Forum on WBAI 99.5 FM, and we're talking about the World Economic Forum with Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, and Doug Henwood, editor of the Left Business Observer. So, Doug, the WEF has become the focus of protest, obviously, the last few years, but it's kind of a vague confab, right, compared to, let's say, the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank, whose effects are extremely clear and which have drawn huge protests to their annual meetings. And this has become the new focus of the anti-globalization or the global justice forces. Is this a bit of a too vague moving target for them?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, well, you know, the organizations like the WTO and the IMF are made up of governments which are, at least in theory, somehow accountable to their populations. You know, obviously, that there's a great gap between theory and practice, but you know, they are at least in theory accountable. A group like the World Economic Forum is really just a private club that's not accountable to anybody, and there's a lot going on in these kinds of informal organizations. There's another one that occurs in the summer, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City hosts a meeting at Jackson Hole where a very similar gang of people get together and have very similar pursuits, although more summertime than Davos in the wintertime kind of pursuit. But the idea is the same. It's kind of informal groupings that bring together political and economic powerhouses, and also, you know, their scribes, journalists, and academics as well. And you know, these things are extremely important for the constitution of the social formation and also the thinking of this global elite. You know, I think it's really we're seeing the formation of a truly international ruling class of a sort that we haven't seen before, at least since the monarchs of Europe were marrying each other a couple of centuries ago. So I think it's you know, it's kind of hard to like you say, it may be kind of a vague target, but I think it's a very important thing to draw attention to, and a very important thing to try to disrupt as much as possible. One of the very exciting things about the World Social Forum is that you know, this is a grouping of the non-elite of the world, popular forces from around the world, who are you know, have a lot of catching up to do. I mean, the elites have been doing this sort of planning for a couple of decades now together, in a way that this formation of a common class, a common way of thinking, a common political approach. And now we're only just seeing in the last couple of years a counter-force developing for the people of the world. And it's a very, very exciting thing. I hope I envy those that will be there. I'll be stuck with a bunch of boring people to hold up our story.
I'm sure you won't be bored because there would be plenty of street protests to keep you entertained. And we will come back to talk about that with Kate Cooper of Another World is Possible slightly later in this program. But I wanted to turn once again to Anuradha Mittal, co-director of the San Francisco-based Food First. You have presented a very positive picture of the World Social Forum, not surprisingly, as with any organization, there are its detractors, including detractors from the left. I've come across, for example, some material in the Brazilian press saying, "Now iremos ao Forum Social." We are not going to the social forum, the World Social Forum. It is not us, because it is just a bunch of reformist leftists. They are not. They don't represent the true left, and so on. Do you think that this is really, should this be taken seriously? Do you give any credibility to such a critique?
Well, you know, I think what Doug said is really important, that this is an opportunity for the progressives, whether you want to call them leftists or reformers, but people who do want to make a change in the current economic system, a chance to come together and see what those alternatives are. And we have not had those opportunities. So I can only speak for Food First. I would say that we are looking forward to the World Social Forum. We know who are many of the actors who are involved in the process. We are looking forward to meet a lot of different groups that we have had no knowledge about before, to learn about their work. And more important, we also recognize that unlike these other people at the World Economic Forum, you know, one shoe doesn't fit all. We realize that there's going to be diversity of alternatives that will be suitable for different local economies, different regions, and we want to know about them.
Right. Yeah, I'm afraid we are running a bit short of time. So an interesting point which I'd like you to take on, a specific point, is what do you hope to get, you as a representative of Food First, but also you as a broad representative of civil society, of left and progressive societies, what specific things would you really like to see come out of this year's World Social Forum?
Well, I think following September 11 tragedy, and all of us are looking for an alternative. And my biggest thing is to start listening and to start comprehending what those different alternatives are. I do believe that a better world is possible. And I also believe that that alternative will come from the civil society. So I'm looking forward to that.
But are there any particular programmatic things which you expect to have come out?
Well, one of the big things, as I said before, is going to be around people's budget. That what are our budgets going to look like if we really want to start challenging hunger with real political will. So I'm really looking forward to actually working with the government of Grand Rio de Sul and seeing what those people's budget look like. What do they look like in India? What will they look like, in San Francisco? Or what they will look like in Brazil? So that is a specific programmatic area that I'm interested in. And also just, moving forward with the agenda.
Right. Right, yeah. Well, definitely. And to move forward with the agenda, moved along with the help of protesters here in New York, as we will talk about in just a second. That was Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, the San Francisco-based nonprofit that deals with hunger as a primary right, food as a primary right, and Doug Henwood, economic journalist, editor of Left Business Observer, and a host of the Thursday edition of Behind the News here in WBAI. And just talking of Rio Grande do Sul, as Anuradha Mittal did, that is in fact the state in Brazil which is run by PT, the Workers' Party, and the city of Porto Alegre is also run by PT. Which brings us to issues of protesting WEF, and we have on the line with us Kate Cooper. Hi, Kate, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Well, Kate, thanks for joining us. You're with this new coalition, Another World is Possible. Why don't you tell us who's in the coalition and why did you form?
Well, we formed to address the World Economic Forum's imminent descending on New York City. The coalition is made up of many different groups and many different individuals from diverse backgrounds, such as environmentalism, labor organizers, anarchists, artists. It's a lot of different kinds of people.
Yeah, some of the groups. We've had representatives of them on this show, including the Coalition for the Human Rights of Immigrants, New York City Direct Action Network, Reclaim the Streets, there's the New York City Anti-Capitalist Convergence, a new group, pretty diverse grouping of people.
Correct.
And so why don't you, we only have a few minutes left in the hour, and we were hoping that you could help situate us with actions. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are going on, that are going to go on in the city in the next 2 weeks. I mean, one good side effect of the WEF coming here is that it's kind of galvanized activists across the city and actually across the whole region to come here. What are some of the things that you're planning?
Well, I made a short list for you guys.
Great.
Another World is Possible and Reclaim the Streets are both planning rallies. And the Another World is Possible Coalition will meet at noon on the 2nd, which is Saturday, at 59th and 5th. It's a green march, meaning, you know, there's no direct action planned.
Right.
And RTS will meet a half an hour earlier, same day, at 11:30 at Columbus Circle. And we will be tangoing and doing the samba. And in typical Carnival Block fashion, and we will probably join up with the Another World is Possible action. There's going to be a press conference this coming Tuesday at 11:30, place to be announced. I can give contact information when we're finished if people are interested in the press conference. There is a social forum taking place at the Brecht Forum this weekend from the 26th to the 27th. There is a counter summit organized by Students for Global Justice at Columbia. That's January 31st to February 3rd. Public Eye on Davos is January 31st to February 3rd. There's a vigil organized by the Pagan Cluster and Another World is Possible. That's Friday night at 6 p.m. in Union Square, I believe. And there's a People's Forum sponsored by the Vieques Support Campaign and Samia Halaby from Al Auda, the Palestinian Right to Return Group, will be speaking. That's the 26th at noon. So, you know, feel free to ask me for details on any of those specific things, but that's a short list of some of the things that are taking place.
I just want to say in parenthesis that we will put all this information on our website. We have this website now, asiapacificforum.org, and all this information we will put on the website for any of our listeners who did not manage to catch those details.
And Kate, before we get to some of the, you know, details that I think you should detail for the audience, let me just ask you one question. I've heard that the city is cracking down on protest and not issuing march permits, for example, to labor and others. You know, how are grassroots activists finding the city's response right now?
I feel like it's a mixed response. The Another World is Possible Coalition has not, as of a few hours ago, had not yet received their permit. We were in negotiations with the police
mm-hmm.
for a permit, but there were negotiations. So I feel like that's something that the city has sat down with us and the NYPD has sat down with us and been in discussions with us about a permit. But at the same time, the NYPD is promising military-style tactics. You may have seen the Village Voice article today, which had some really scary-looking photos of police doing, like, mock... they were doing preparations for these rallies, and it looked, you know, as if they were getting ready to be very violent.
Well, and they were using, I mean, to my very great chagrin, since I'm a longtime Voice contributor, the language in that article, you know, just reproduced the worst kind of hysterical police rhetoric about protesters, comparing Al-Qaeda terrorists and so forth. And, you know, it's a shame because the piece really didn't challenge that kind of rhetoric from the police.
It was the worst piece that's been printed about us so far.
Yeah. I mean, I feel terrible about it myself. But if that's the kind of attitude that the cops are taking towards protesters and once, you know, raising the spectacle of violent anarchists and so forth, it's a pretty scary prospect considering the fact that, you know, hundreds and thousands of people are coming into the city right now to protest.
Right. It is scary.
Actually, in terms of September 11th and all the restrictions that have come in as a consequence, have you had to change your ideas about how you're going to hold this protest?
Not really. I think what September 11th did for the anti-corporate globalization movement was almost to reinforce what we knew already, that there's immense injustice in the world. There are a lot of people who are miserable and hungry and poor, And sometimes that leads to a desperation that leads to atrocities, like September 11th. And, you know, that sort of misery and poverty and rage, these are the things that in this movement we work against. So it sort of makes everything we believe in seem even more pressing and salient.
Well, as you said before, I mean, there's a ton of stuff for people to do, a diversity of options and a diversity of tactics in the next 2 weeks. And where's a good place for people to go to learn about the various things, the social forum, the counter summit, the student counter summit at Columbia, and then the various protest marches and events?
Shall I give you some websites?
That'd be great.
Okay, there's anotherworldispossible.com. There's accnyc.org. That's the New York Anti-Capitalist Convergence. There's studentsforglobaljustice.org. And let's see. The Vieques Support Campaign's People's Forum, you can email vieqesse@hotmail.com.
And all of there are links to all of these sites at anotherworldispossible.com.
Correct.
Right? So that's one word, anotherworldispossible.com. And also regular listeners of Asia Pacific Forum can go to our website, asiapacificforum.org, and we'll have a link to all these sites as well.
Thank you very much, Kate. That was Kate Cooper of Another World is Possible, a New York coalition that includes NYC Anti-Capitalist Convergence, the Coalition for the Human Rights of Immigrants, NYC Direct Action Network, Reclaim the Streets, and many more. Well, we are running fast out of time, so let's end with a few quick public service announcements. First, there is a meeting of Concerned Friends for WBAI. It will hold its first general meeting of the post-victory era tomorrow, Thursday, January 24th, at 6:30 p.m., Riverside Church, South Hall on Level 1. That is Riverside Church at 6:30 p.m. It's at 91 Claremont Avenue between 120th and 122nd Street, one block west of Broadway. You can call 212-266-1000. Bernard White would be speaking there, as well as Miguel Maldonado, the chair of the local advisory board. For more information, call the Concerned Friends hotline at 800-825-00. That is 800-825-0055, the first general meeting of Concerned Friends tomorrow, 6:30.
And I suppose that's really all we have time for today.
A couple of quick ones. Okay. The local advisory board had a resolution yesterday that it resolved to agree to the fundraiser here in WBAI, although the question of the national fundraiser is left open. And finally, there is one a cultural event that I would like the listeners to know. This Friday, there is a reading by Arab and Afghan American poets at the American Museum of National History. Friday, 6:30 to 8:30, call 212-769-5200. Reading by Arab and Afghan American poets called Words in Action. Well, that's it, folks. I am Aniruddha Das of Asia Pacific Forum, and I was co-hosting with Andy Shao. You can reach us at 212-209-2991. That's 212-209-2991. You can also call us at apforum@yahoogroups.com. That's APFORUM @yahoogroups.com. And don't forget to visit our website, www.asiapacificforum.org. That's one word, asiapacificforum.org. I'm also a member of Samar, S-A-M-A-R, www.samarmagazine.org. And I look forward to hearing from you, and tune in once again tomorrow, next Wednesday at 9 o'clock. Right now, stay tuned for another edition of Cat Radio Cafe. In my mind.
This is WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe.